but the attempt is from the first desperate one. Holland is two-fifths Catholic, and it was only the First World War, with its consequent territorial adjustments, that prevented the German Empire from showing, as it must have shown in a few more years, a majority of Catholic citizens. All the redistribution of Europe had, and since Versailles, never conceived in a spirit friendly to Catholic interests, has failed to obscure the fact that Catholicism pervades Europe. Meanwhile, recent events have done much to rob the schismatic Eastern churches of their political solidarity and of their spiritual prestige. Catholicism is admittedly the most successful of the missionary religions, and its growth in the New World is sufficiently attested by the alarm of its ill-wishers. Whoever wishes to find men of his own faith, wherever there are men of his own species, if he does not actually wish to be a Catholic, must at least wish that he were a Catholic. But even these glories of the Church are accidental glories. It was not a memorial, it was not worldwide, on the day of Pentecost. There is another quality of Catholicism, more intimate and more integral, which at once repels and attracts the men of our generation. I mean the claim of the Church to authority in matters of faith and morals. This claim will, of course, occupy us throughout the present work. It has to be treated here only so far as it is, to some souls, a magnet of attraction which draws them towards the Catholic system. When I say that the people of our time, and especially the young people of our time, want authority, I do not mean that they desire to be controlled by a coercive authority from without, only an ascetic desires that for its own sake. I mean that, in the literal and primitive sense of the word, authority, they want a warrant to authorize them in doing what they do, sanctions to justify them in behaving as they behave. This is, I believe, a characteristic symptom of our age, and very largely a post-war symptom. In normal times, there is no such demand. Decent people, whatever their beliefs, are content to be guided in matters of conduct by the deliveries of their own uninstructed consciences. For, after all, the rule of man's conduct is written in his own heart. Neither Catholicism nor any other form of Christianity pretends to have a special morality of its own. Religion is meant to enforce, not to supersede, the natural code of morals. Christianity, for example, forbids suicide, but then, so did Plato. Ideally, the perfect pagan should interpret his moral duties exactly as a Christian would. But within the last 50 years, or so, an open challenge has been issued to traditional morality in matters concerning sex. A steady, ceaseless howl of literary propaganda has shaken the faith of our generation in the indissolubility of marriage, hitherto conceived as a principle of natural morality. Let anyone contrast Jane Eyre with the average modern novel, and he will see how far our thought has traveled. Half a century ago it was assumed, even in more or less free-thinking circles, that divorce was a disreputable subject, and that remarriage after divorce was a disqualification for respectable society. Today, such principles are maintained among Christians only with hesitation, among free-thinkers not at all. Within the last few years a second challenge has been issued, by a less open, but not less formidable propaganda, against the fruitfulness of marriage. Practices hitherto connected with the unmentioned underworld of society have found their way into the home. Once again, it is not merely a Christian principle that has been thrown overboard. It is a point over which Jewish moralists are no less definite than our own. Ovid and Juvenal, with no flicker of Christian revelation to guide them, branded the practices in question with the protest of heathen satire. It is not Christian morality, but natural morality as hitherto conceived, that has been outraged by the change of standard. Now, the healthier part of our fellow citizens does not want to see the effects of either propaganda carried to their logical conclusion. No decent person wants free love, no decent person wants race suicide. They live, therefore, not by principle, but by a compromise between principles. They are in favor of divorce, but not of easy divorce, of small families, but not of too small families. Consequently, they feel themselves responsible for the decision, where exactly the line shall be drawn, within the generous limits which our legal system allows. They do not like the responsibility who, in tampering with institutions so sacred as those of the family, would not like to feel that he had an authority behind him, a warrant from somewhere to ratify his behavior. If only there were some great spiritual institution which would act, in these matters, as a sort of public conscience, guiding, from a higher point of vision, the moral choice made by the individual. So, naturally, he feels, unfortunately, he does not feel that the views of any non-Catholic denomination are worth having, even if they are discoverable. He knows that the advice of an individual clergyman will be unofficial and inexpert. He knows, if he has followed the course of recent ecclesiastical deliberations, that representatives of Christian thought speak with an uncertain voice on such subjects. He respects our church for having, at least, definite opinions and fixed rules. He respects it, although he disagrees with it. He thinks us far too severe in forbidding remarriage after divorce, in forbidding the artificial restriction of the family, but, although he disagrees with us for the rules we have, he respects us for having rules. If only the people whom we value as advisors would give us the advice we want. Moral hesitations chiefly affect the young. Intellectual hesitations are commonly put off until they reach an age when the mind has become more reflective and, alas, less adventurous. It is the chief tragedy of life that, whereas logically thought should precede action, in the development of men's career action precedes thought. Men who are becoming middle-aged, with families growing up and asking the eternal questions of youth, feel an ill-defined gap in their minds, if they have no creed to live by, and are apt to take more notice of what the religious world is doing. They can hardly become attentive to its symptoms today, without recognizing, and being disturbed by, the chaos of religious sentiment which I made some attempt to describe in the foregoing chapter. They see how rapidly the fashions of thought are changing, how landmarks of tradition have been removed even within their own lifetime. They are conscious that even their own hesitating infidelities, the vogue of their youth, are becoming back numbers, as fresh doubts and fresh heresies crowd them out. The reaction from this constant flux of innovation disposes their minds, I will not say towards the idea of certitude, but towards the idea of fixity in religious beliefs. To be told, by optimistic clerical friends, that the present age is only a period of transition, and that in 20 or 30 years' time a clearer perception of spiritual truths is bound to emerge, is hardly consoling to them. They think of their gray hairs, and wonder whether they will live to see it. For that matter, the clerical optimist has been saying the same thing steadily these 100 years past. Is it wonderful if they sometimes listen to catch the whisper of an authoritative voice? They do not, as a rule, want authority in matters of belief for the right reason, that is, that the whole notion of revealed religion becomes logically impossible without it. They do not understand that the whole edifice of non-Catholic theology has always been doomed to wreck, because it never had any foundation in reason. But they do see that, here and now, there is no tradition so long established that it cannot be questioned, no doctrine so venerable that it cannot be controverted. They do see that the leaders of Protestant thought are desperately guessing at the truth and covering up their uncertainties with equivocal phrases and sentimental whitewash. Really, the sight of it would almost make you want to be a Roman Catholic, if the Roman Catholics did not believe such impossible things. The instinct for beauty, the instinct for mystery, the instinct for naturalness, the instinct for history, the instinct for worldwide citizenship, the instinct for moral guidance, the instinct for intellectual definiteness, all these, or any of these, may make a man, do make many men, look towards the Catholic Church, if not with less reprobation, at least with more interest, if not with less ignorance, at least with more curiosity. Some wish they could become Catholics, some wish they had been born Catholics, some content themselves with saying that it must be very nice to be a Catholic. If only they could tell the first lie, as someone has put it, how easily all the rest would follow. 3. Telling the first lie. That phrase about telling the first lie is a particularly revealing one. It reveals not the attitude of Catholics towards religious truth, but the ignorance of non-Catholics about the religion of their fellow countrymen. I shall be accused, perhaps, of a sulky querulousness. When I say this, it will be conjectured that I am revenging myself on those who do not agree with me by pretending that they do not understand me, but it is true, and it is a truth which becomes more luminous the more you come in contact with the public attitude towards Catholics, that the English people, when it talks about the Catholic Church, loses all sense of reality, of human possibilities. We were for so long a despised and persecuted sect, we were for so long deprived of any opportunity to explain our position, that Englishmen have come to look upon us as a race of ogres, from whom nothing natural, nothing human can be expected. They will believe anything of us without stopping to inquire whether such beliefs are even plausible. Among half a dozen instances of this credulity, let me select one that is peculiarly striking and peculiarly well attested. At the beginning of the First World War, when it was suggested to the government that Catholics, like their neighbors, would need an increased staff of chaplains to superintend their spiritual welfare, a cabinet minister professed himself astonished that the ministrations of French priests would not be sufficient, and when it was pointed out to him that these priests would find some difficulty in hearing confessions, it proved that the cabinet minister had assumed, all his life, that Catholics made their confessions in Latin. One pictures those Irish troops, a Kennedy, in every knapsack. So true is it that the English sense of realities breaks down when the habits of Catholics are in question. By an equally grotesque illusion, most Englishmen have the idea that Catholics base all their religious beliefs on the authority of the Church, and if we press them with the difficulty, yes, but on what do Catholics base their belief in the authority of the Church? Do they base that on the authority of the Church too? I suspect that most Englishmen would reply, of course, these people are Catholics, therefore any reason or no reason is good enough for them. They are a race apart, ogres, not men. Let me then, to avoid further ambiguity, give a list of certain leading doctrines as which no Catholic, upon a moment's reflection, could accept on the authority of the Church, and on that ground alone. I. The existence of God. 2. Period. The fact that He has made a revelation to the world in Jesus Christ. 3. The life in its broad outlines, the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. 4. The fact that our Lord founded a church. 5. The fact that He bequeathed to that church His own teaching office, with the guarantee naturally that it should not err in teaching. 6. The consequent intellectual duty of believing what the Church believes. I do not say that these considerations are present to the mind of every Catholic, however ignorant, however stupid. I do say that these are the considerations which any Catholic teacher would put before him, if and in so far as he showed any curiosity about the matter. I would add that a glance at the Penny Catechism will disabuse any unbiased mind of the idea that the Church, even in dealing with simple folk, conceals from them the intellectual basis of their religion. Yet the average Protestant persists in believing that the attitude of the Church towards the human intellect is adequately summed up in the phrase, familiar to us from childhood, "Open your mouth and shut your eyes." It is supposed that anybody who is brought up as a Catholic retains, without any further questioning or instruction on the point, the pious credulity with which he accepted all that his mother told him, all that the priest told him, when he was too young to think for himself. Any dawning doubts as to the sufficiency of such a motive for belief are crushed, we must suppose, with threats of hell and excommunication. This would be extraordinary enough, considering the number of Catholics there are in the world and the ample opportunities they have for being infected, in a world like ours, with the germs of unbelief. But, still more extraordinary, this Church, which has no proof of anything she says beyond her own bare assertion, is making converts, in an enlightened country like ours, at the rate of some 12,000 in the year. How does she manage, one wonders, to play off her confidence trick with such repeated success? This is, indeed, a phenomenon at which non-Catholics profess to feel the utmost astonishment, but it is a kind of astonishment which has grown blunted by usage. They have come to regard it as part of the order of things, that their neighbors should become the victims, now and again, of this extraordinary tour de force. If they were compelled to picture to themselves the process of a conversion, they would, I suppose, conceive it something after this fashion: that the mind of the inquirer is hypnotized into acquiescence by the crafty blandishments of a designing priest, not by his arguments, for he has none. He only goes on shouting, "Become a Catholic, or you will go to hell," not by his arguments, but by some fatal quality of fascination, which we breed, no doubt, in the seminaries. In a dazed condition, like that of the bird under the snake's eye, he assents to every formula presented to him, binds himself by every oath that is proposed to him, in one open-mouthed act of unreasoning surrender. After that, of course, pride forbids him to admit, so long as life lasts, that the choice so made was a mistaken one. Besides, one knows the power these priests have. Yes, it is very curious, the power attributed to these priests. When you have had the privilege of assisting at their education for 7 years, you feel that "curious" is too weak a word for it. This is, presumably, what Protestants have in mind when they represent submission to the Church as a form of intellectual suicide. They mean that the act of faith which a man makes in joining the Church is an act of the will, or, more properly speaking, the emotions, in which the intellect plays no part. It is an entertaining fact, familiar to all who are acquainted with the history of Protestantism, that one of the earliest and one of the fiercest controversies between the Reformation and the old religion was concerned precisely with this point. It was, of course, the Protestants who maintained the view that faith was an act of the will, or, more properly speaking, the emotions, with frequent allusion to the misunderstood text, "With the heart man believeth unto salvation," whereas their Catholic opponents earned bitter hatred by insisting that the act of faith, however much directed by the will, had its seat in the intellect. Historically, Protestantism is committed to the notion that the act of faith is the mere surrender of a personality to a personality, without parley, without deliberation, without logical motive. The true representative of Protestantism in the modern world is the Salvationist who stands up at a street corner and cries out, "I am saved." It is Catholicism which insists that, ideally at least, it is the intellect which must be satisfied first, the heart afterwards. Nor, in point of fact, has modern Protestantism any right to tax us with exalting faith at the expense of reason. It was only the other day that I read an able defense of theism by an Anglican philosopher who appeared to demand faith of some kind as a preliminary to accepting the doctrine of God's existence. No Catholic apologist ever fell into so grotesque an error. We demand, indeed, on the part of the inquirer certain negative dispositions, as an absence of prejudice and of frivolity, a willingness to listen and to attend, determination in carrying an argument to its logical conclusion, etc. But to demand of the inquirer any positive will to believe as the condition of accepting the existence of God is to beg the whole question, to stultify the whole process of philosophical discussion. Nobody who will take the trouble to look at any manual of Catholic apologetics will fail to understand that several of the questions most controverted today do not fall, from the Catholic point of view, under the object of faith, at least primarily. They are matters upon which we have to make up our minds beforehand, logically speaking, as a condition of making any act of faith at all. And when I say make up our minds, I mean not a mere decision of the will, but a satisfaction of the intellect. The existence of God, the authority of Christ, and so on, are beliefs which meet us and have to be dealt with before we get on to the act of faith at all. They are the preambles of faith, the motives of credibility, and we have to deal with them by a reasoning process which throws the responsibility for our decision not upon the authority of the Church, but upon our own private judgment. Every convert, when he goes under instruction, has to follow these arguments to the best of his ability. Nor is it only for the sake of converts that we insist upon this intellectual duty. A class in apologetics is part of the normal curriculum of a Catholic school. Catholic boys are learning to defend the existence of God at an age when you, and I, reader, were dismally memorizing facts about the career of Jehoshaphat, and gnashing our teeth on the South Galatian theory. When you have contrived to persuade him that, for Catholics, the authority of the Church in matters of faith is not a self-evident axiom, but a truth arrived at by a process of argument, the Protestant controversialist has his retort ready. You admit, then, after all, he says, that a man has to use his own private judgment in order to arrive at religious truth. Why, then, what is the use of authority in religion at all? I had always supposed that there was a straight issue between us, you supporting authority, and I private judgment. I had always supposed that you criticized me for my presumption in searching for God. By the light of my imperfect human reason, it proves, now, that you are no less guilty of such presumption, and myself. Surely your reproaches are inconsistent, and your distinctions unnecessary. If you use your private judgment to establish certain cardinal points of theology, the existence of God, the authority of Christ, and so on, why may not I use my private judgment to establish not only these, but all other points of theology? Questions such as the doctrine of the Blessed Trinity, or the real presence in the Eucharist. You can hardly blame me for using the very privileges which you have just claimed so eagerly for yourself. I could not have imagined, if I had not heard it with my own ears, the accent of surprise with which Protestants suddenly light upon this startling discovery, that the belief we Catholics have in authority is based upon an act of private judgment. How on earth could they ever suppose we taught otherwise? I say nothing here of the grace of faith, which is the hidden work of God in our souls, but how could the conscious process by which we arrive at any form of the truth begin without an act of private judgment? I may, indeed, overcome by a kind of emotional crisis, surrender myself unreflectively to an influence imaginatively experienced, but that is not Catholicism, it is Protestantism, it is conversion in its crudest form. If I employ my reason at all, if I employ my reason only so far as to say, the Church says this, and the Church is infallible, therefore this must be true, even so I am using private judgment, it is my own reason which draws its conclusions from the syllogism, reject private judgment. Of course Catholics have never rejected private judgment, they only profess to limit the spheres in which private judgment and authority have their respective parts to play. Is it really so difficult to see that revealed religion demands, from its very nature, a place for private judgment and a place for authority? A place for private judgment, in determining that the revelation itself comes from God, in discovering the medium through which that revelation comes to us, and the rule of faith by which we are enabled to determine what is, and what is not, revealed, a place for authority to step in, when these preliminary investigations are over, and say, now, be careful, for you are out of your depth here. How many persons subsist in the unity of the divine nature? What value and what power underlies the mystery of sacramental worship? How divine grace acts upon the human will? These and 100 other questions are questions which your human reason cannot investigate for itself, and upon which it can pronounce no sentence, since it moves in the natural, not in the supernatural order. At this point, then, you must begin to believe by hearsay. From this point onwards you must ask, not to be convinced, but to be taught, is it really so illogical in us to fix the point at which our private judgment is no longer of any service? Are we really more inconsistent than the bather, who steps out cautiously through the shallow water, and then, when it is breast-high, spreads out his hands to swim? But there is a subtle and a more telling variation of the same argument. The strength of a chain, we are reminded, is that of its weakest link. We Catholics profess to establish the truths of religion by a chain of argument. This chain, then, is no stronger than the weakest link in it. How is it that we profess to hold with absolute certitude the revealed truths of our religion? Reasonable enough to say that if your Church is infallible, the doctrines which she preaches are evidently true, and capable of producing absolute certitude in the mind, but the infallibility of your Church is not a self-evident axiom. It is a proposition which you have proved, and proved it by an appeal to ordinary human reason. Is it not clear, then, that in the last resort every statement which your church makes rests upon the validity of the arguments by which, in the first instance, you proved your church infallible? Now, these arguments, based as they are upon human reason, do not convey absolute certitude to the mind. They may be, in your view, overwhelmingly probable. Nay, they may be certain with all human certainty, but human certainty is not absolute certainty. There is always a possible margin of error. You cannot prove the existence of God, the authority of Christ, or His commission to His church, beyond all possibility of doubt. How then can you suppose that you have proved beyond all possibility of doubt the statements which you receive on the church's authority? To escape this dilemma, Catholic apologists have frequently used a metaphor which seems to me, I confess, singularly unfortunate. They tell us that the motives of credibility by which we establish the divine origin of the Church and her teaching office are like the scaffolding which is put up while a building is being erected. Once the building operations are complete, the scaffolding is unnecessary. It has served its turn, and we pay it no further attention. Now, theologically speaking, that metaphor will pass well enough. They mean that the true motive of our belief, seen on its supernatural side, is the infallible veracity of God, in His revelation. But for purposes of apologetic, we shall employ such a metaphor in vain. Our critics will not be slow to point out that we erect a building inside the scaffolding, not on the top of the scaffolding. And if we did erect a building on the top of our scaffolding, we could not take the scaffolding away without letting the building fall to the ground. Our own parable has been turned against us. It will be better to avoid the metaphor, and to keep in mind the distinction just mentioned. The motives of credibility, satisfying his intellect, bring the inquirer up to the point of making the act of faith. That act recognizes God's authority in the Church's teaching, and the absolute nature of His authority does make all the difference to the kind of certitude with which, thenceforward, he holds the truths of Catholic doctrine. But this is inherent in the act of faith, not in the chain of proof by which the Catholic claim is established. Having made the act of faith, he cannot produce more or better arguments to convince his neighbor than he could have produced before. Apologetically, then, revealed truths have no higher certitude than the arguments by which the fact of revelation is established. The revealed proposition that there are three persons in the Blessed Trinity is not, apologetically, more certain than the statement established in the first instance by private judgment that our Lord left the charisma of infallibility to His Church. The Catholic claim does not profess to be based on a mathematical certainty. The proposition, things which are equal to the same thing are equal to one another, is evident in the sense that the contrary proposition is unthinkable. The proposition, Jesus of Nazareth suffered under Pontius Pilate, is not evident in that sense. The contrary proposition, in this case, does not defy our thought. In historical statements and every revealed religion must depend, in the last resort, upon an historical statement. The highest kind of certainty you can attain is that which excludes reasonable doubt. That is the kind of proof which Catholicism claims for those preliminary considerations which it calls the motives of credibility, and consequently no point of Catholic doctrine can claim anything better than this historical kind of proof. The absolute certainty with which we believe the teaching of the Church comes to us from the supernatural grace of faith, which transforms our reason conviction into a higher quality, the water, as at Cana, is turned into wine. But for apologetic purposes, a reason conviction is all we can offer to our neighbors, and it is this reason conviction which the present thesis attempts to maintain. It will be observed that those Platonic admirers of the Catholic system, whom I referred to in the last chapter, the people who wish they were Catholics without having in fact any intention of becoming Catholics, are usually guilty of an utter misconception. They imagine that the Catholic Church is asking them to make a leap in the dark, and they feel, sometimes, as if they would like to make that leap, or rather, to have made it, because it would save them the trouble of any intellectual effort. If only they could be trepanned into the Church, if only they could be shanghaied on board the Ark of Peter, the passage would quite possibly, they feel, be a pleasant one. but the church is not asking them to take any such sudden leap, will not allow them, in fact, to assume rights of membership until they have been through a course of intellectual instruction. It is their duty to satisfy their own minds, proportionately to their general level of mental culture, about God's existence, the authority of Christ, etc., before they can expect the grace of faith to come to them. A full statement of Catholic belief may, of course, be made without entering into apologetic considerations at all. The question, "What do Catholics teach?" may be interpreted as a demand, inspired by enlightened curiosity, to have the revealed doctrines which we inculcate set forth in an orderly scheme. But the reader of such a document, unless he is himself a Catholic, or at least a catechumen, holds these doctrines at arm's length, as he considers them, regards them merely as an expose of his neighbor's religious psychology. They have not, for him, the interest of an appeal, or a challenge. I am fully conscious how difficult it is for anyone to make such an appeal, such a challenge successfully, fully conscious that my own qualifications for the task are at best those of an amateur, not those of a specialist. But I am writing in the hope, not merely of informing the reader, but of persuading him, or at least of contributing to that end. Consequently, I must take nothing for granted. I must adopt for my model the author whom Horace condemned for beginning his Epic of Troy with the story of Leda's egg. I must assume that the reader has an open mind even on the question whether God exists or number. I am the more encouraged to take this course by the fact that in our day many intelligent people who profess themselves theists hold their beliefs precariously and unreflectively, without troubling to inquire what they involve, nay, that Christians themselves, from lack of systematic instruction, often misconceive the nature of the God whom their own theology preaches, and are halfway towards pantheism, without knowing it. It will do no harm to test each link in the chain of Christian apologetic, be the hand that wields the hammer never so unworkmanlike. 4. The God who hides himself. Philosophers have continually been exercised by the question whether our knowledge of God is a direct or a derived knowledge, whether the idea of God is in some way native to the mind, or whether we arrive at it through our knowledge of other things, his creatures. The mystical temperament, which has a strong influence on the outlook of Protestant theologians, is naturally disposed to claim, if the claim can in any way be justified, that our knowledge of God is direct. For it is the instinct of the mystic to reject as far as possible all interference, all mediation, between God and the soul. The simplest, the most plausible of all these theories is traditionalism. As a matter of observation, it is plainly true that the origin from which your knowledge of God is derived, or mine, is the assurance given to us in infancy by our mothers, or those who were responsible for our education. What if this should be not only the origin, but the justification of the concept? Adam, we must suppose, had in some way an experimental knowledge of God's existence. Did not he, in the strength of that knowledge, make theists of his sons, and they of theirs, and so on down the whole series of history, until at last the information came to our mothers, and through them to us? The evidence we have, in that case, for the existence of God is a tradition, perpetuated through the long course of human history, and resting in the last resort on the testimony of men who had walked with God, who had had first-hand knowledge of the facts. Or, failing that, there is a possible refuge in fideism. After all, religion is concerned with the supernatural order, which altogether transcends ours. Why should there not be a special supernatural revelation to man which enables him to apprehend the existence of God, made, if you will, before he is yet old enough to be conscious of the fact? Is it not, perhaps, the best account we can give of this persistent human belief in a deity, to suppose that there is a special faculty implanted in all of us at birth, but obscured in some of us by faults of training, or of character, which apprehends God, by a simple act, unintellectual, because it is supra-intellectual? One philosopher at least, Descartes, would go further than this, and claim that for this purpose no supernatural revelation was needed. The thinking mind, according to his analysis, was primarily conscious of to clear and distinct ideas, itself, and God. Outward things, the phenomena of sense, were only mirrored for it through the medium of its own consciousness, but the two facts of its own existence and God's were guaranteed to it antecedently to any reasoning whatsoever. At the very basis of all our thought lay the perception of a God, who was responsible for implanting in us the ideas with which our thought is concerned. His non-existence was worse than unthinkable. It would destroy the very possibility of all knowledge. You must believe in God in order to believe in anything at all. This was at the dawn of idealism, but a theory not altogether dissimilar had found patronage even in the scholastic age, I mean the ontological proof, which is usually connected with the name of Saint Anselm. The idea of God was necessarily one of supreme perfection. It was impossible to associate the notion of any fault or defect with the idea of God. But the notion of non-existence is the notion of a fault or defect, indeed, a very considerable one. Therefore it is impossible to associate the notion of non-existence with the idea of God. Therefore it is unthinkable that God should not exist. Therefore God exists. This attempt to prove the existence of God, or to declare the proof of it unnecessary, without reference to the effects of His power which we experience in His visible creation, is a permanent temptation to the human mind. Intellects as far removed from one another as those of Anselm, Descartes, and de Bonald have undertaken it, and it is probable that they will never lack successors. Protestant thought, in our day, is much wedded not to these, but to similar speculations. Thus, you will seldom read any piece of non-Catholic apologetic without coming across some reference to man's sense of his need for God, or man's notion of holiness, a notion which can only be perfectly realized in God. The implication of all such language is that it is possible to argue directly from the existence of concepts in our own mind to the existence of real objects to which those concepts correspond. The Catholic Church discountenances all such methods of approach to the subject. Some of them, at the Vatican Council, she has actually condemned. She discountenances them, at least, if and in so far as they claim to be the sole, or the main argument for the existence of God. The main, if not the sole, argument for the existence of God, so she holds, and has always held, is the argument which proves the unseen, from the seen, the existence of the Creator, from His visible effects in creation. All these efforts at the solution of the problem really depend for their plausibility on a postulate which we do not grant, namely, that it would have been impossible for the human race to infer God's existence from His creatures. If this were true, then it might be argued that the notion of God must be an idea directly communicated to our minds. Such an argument is perfectly valid if applied to our sense of right and wrong. It must be native to the mind, because there is nothing outside ourselves which could possibly have suggested such a notion to us. But this is a simple idea, directly entertained, whereas the idea of God is a composite idea, and the attributes which we associate with it, power, wisdom, etc., are derived from our own experience. If there had been no God, said Napoleon, it would have been necessary to invent Him. At least, we may say it would have been possible to invent Him. Thus the fact that the idea of God is conceived by our minds does not necessarily mean that it is inborn in us, or that it is directly communicated to us by some supernatural light. The supposition is an unnecessary one, and now, what has it to say for itself? If it were true, as Descartes held, that the idea of God was a clear and distinct idea, like that of our own existence, why is it that there are so few fools in the world who doubt their own existence, so many who say, there is no God? If the existence of God was one of the first principles of all our mental process, then the contrary idea, that there is no God, should be unthinkable. But is it unthinkable? People think it every day. But at least, Saint Anselm would retort, it is impossible to think of an imperfect God, and therefore it is impossible to think of a non-existent God. To which the atheist replies with some justice, that, since God does not exist, it is not necessary to think about Him at all. You cannot argue from the ideal to the real order of things. The apologist is on safer ground if he leaves the arena of philosophy altogether and maintains that the notion of God, so far from being innate in our minds, is something supernaturally implanted in them by a kind of direct revelation. That some such revelation was made to our first parents, we have no ground for disputing, but it would need robust faith in us to accept so momentous a doctrine on the remote authority of our first parents, even if popular science would give us leave to suppose that we had any. Can we really be certain that in so many centuries of transmission the revelation has remained intact, that the tale has not lost in the telling? On the other hand, fideism would have us believe that such a direct revelation is made not once for all to the human race, but to each individual soul. Is it? The argument is surely one of those which admit of no refutation, and produce no conviction. It is impossible to disprove the assertion that a direct revelation was made to us at time of life from which no memories remain to us, but equally it is impossible to prove it, and if some other account can be given of the means by which the race or the individual arrives at the knowledge of God, surely this rather desperate hypothesis is best left in the limbo of mere conjecture. I know there is a fashion amongst modern apologists to write as if man possessed a religious sense comparable to his sense of music. This sense of the argument runs, is most highly developed in the saint, the mystic, who is the real artist, the real connoisseur. In most men it is much less developed, in some it is hardly developed at all. Not that anyone, God forbid, can be born absolutely tone-deaf to the airs of this heavenly music, but, through lack of development, the talent is nearly buried. There is no response, or practically no response, made by such a soul to the divine voice within. The spiritual man discerns spiritual things. He cannot explain to you what his experiences are, or even how he knows that they are real, any more than the musical expert can explain his emotional experiences to the mere groundling. But he knows. He has had an unmistakable experience of God's presence. It does not become us, the ignorant amateurs, to dispute his judgment. We can only trust to his higher instincts, and hope that we, too, perhaps, may be privileged to hear now and again some echo of the strains that ravish him. For the life of me, I could never understand how far such authors mean their metaphor to be pressed. Is it really contended that we can argue from a state of mind to an objective reality which lies behind it? If a musical enthusiast, after listening to some rare but gay piece, should tell me that as he listened he could actually see elves and gnomes dancing before his eyes, I should be perfectly prepared to reverence both his own superior sensitiveness to musical impressions and the subtle power of the art which could evoke such an imaginative experience. I should not suppose that elves or gnomes had been present, unseen to myself, and I confess that if I lacked the sense of religion quite so thoroughly as I lack that of music, the disclosures of the mystic would leave me in very much the same position. I might feel the mystic to be of a spiritual caliber infinitely superior to my own. I might bestow my admiration on those methods of contemplative prayer which enabled him to achieve his sense of a divine presence, his sense of union. But I should not for that reason be inclined to believe in the objective existence of God, his angels, or his saints, if I did not share those beliefs already. I do not know if I am wholly removed from the generality of mankind in holding such sentiments, but this type of argument seems to me both logically unsound and theologically perilous, and the nerve of the fallacy lies, I think, in the use of the word experience. When we are asked to let ourselves be guided by the experiences of another in matters of common human importance, we acquiesce if we do acquiesce, because the experiences in question are such as might have fallen to our lot instead of his. We have eyes, ears, and the other senses corresponding to his, and we can take the measure of his faculties from our own. If he says he saw a thing, we can relate that to our own experience of sight. If he says he heard a thing, we can relate it to our own sense of hearing. But if a man talks to us of experiences in which the faculties of outward sensation played no part, we are no longer in a position to sample those experiences for ourselves by proxy. We have no apparatus for sharing them with him. Where an experience of the outward senses is concerned, we are ready, from the analogy of our own experience, to believe that there was something there. But when the alleged experience has been apprehended through the use of spiritual faculties which we either do not possess or do not use, our confidence in the something there necessarily evaporates. Which is, I suppose, why the Church tells us that a private revelation may be such as to demand credence from the soul which experiences it, but can never, of itself, demand credence from other people. Nevertheless, the moderns, in their desire for an easy shortcut to the proof of God's existence, are learning to rest more and more weight on this tenuous argument, as I think, fatally. In the same way, they press for more than it is worth the argument, impressive enough in itself, that, when all is said and done, most people do believe in God. Buddhism, Hinduism, Paganism have at least theologies of their own. Jewry and Islam acknowledge, no less than Christendom, one God, who is both transcendent and omnipotent. In England itself, for all the decline of official Christianity which we were considering three chapters back, how much is there of positive atheism? Nor is the appeal to history less impressive, with a thousand strange vagaries of presentation. Humanity has nearly always, nearly everywhere, attested its belief in the existence of unseen powers. Atheism nearly always, nearly everywhere, has been the reaction of a minority, a protest defying the popular instinct. Must there not, argues the apologist, be something in this popular certainty? Have we not been taught to remember that there is no smoke without fire? We can hardly account for this vast conspiracy of mankind, determined to bow down before some august power, conceived as intelligent and present to the worshipper. We can hardly account for the satisfaction of men's highest instincts through such commerce with the unseen, except on the supposition which, after all, cannot be disproved, that the God, so worshipped, under a thousand forms and in a thousand manners does really exist. This contention, put in its most naked form, means that each of us ought to believe in God, because all the others do, an arrangement not differing much in principle from the economics of that famous country, whose inhabitants lived by taking in one another's washing. Once more we must insist, you cannot argue from a mere state of mind to an objective reality which that state of mind appears to presuppose. If indeed there were no way of accounting for this strange idea having got into so many people's heads, then the mere fact of its prevalence might make us suspect that there was something in it. But, as we shall see presently, it is possible to give some account of how the idea of God comes into men's minds. Or again, if each human being independently discovered the idea of God for himself, we might hesitate to ascribe the phenomenon to mere coincidence, but the doctrine of God's existence is one that is taught to childhood, one that is often bound up, superstitiously, with national hopes, with social ordinances. Even if there were no God, it is probable enough that many people would believe in his existence. It would not be more surprising than the belief in luck, for example, or the belief in omens. No. The true lesson of this widespread and obstinate theism among our fellow men is a slightly different one. The fact that so many men believe in a God ought to set us wondering whether there are not, perhaps, reasons for such a belief to which we have not hitherto devoted sufficient attention, or perhaps reasons which we scorn to look into because we had vaguely been given to understand that they were out of date and unfashionable. Mankind's belief in God is a rebuke to, and a condemnation of, the careless atheist, for it is the height of rashness, or of pride, to assume without investigation that so large a part of the race is giving credit to an illusion for the existence of which no rational grounds can be assigned. In a word, the existence of religion is a challenge to us to consider eagerly whether there are not grounds for believing in God's existence, philosophical grounds which will be as cogent for us as they have been for others. When I say philosophical, I do not mean that it is the duty of the bushman, or of the charcoal burner, to go through a series of carefully arranged scholastic syllogisms. I mean that there exists among mankind a sort of rough, common-sense metaphysic which demands as its first postulate the existence of a divine principle in things. It can be refined, it can be reduced to terms, by the nice ratiocinations of the philosopher. It is equally valid, we hold, whether as it presents itself to the charcoal burner or, as it presents itself to the sage.